Chapter 16. Settling Accounts. 1. Crooked Warden, Silent 13th, your servant calls. Place your eyes upon the passing of this woman, Esri Del Mastro, Yono's servant and yours. Beloved of a man who is beloved by you. Locke's voice broke, and he struggled for self-control. Beloved of a man who is my brother. We grudge you this one, Lord, and I don't mind saying so. 38 left standing. 50 they'd put over the side, and the rest had been lost during the battle. Locke and Zemira shared the funeral duties. Locke's recitations had grown more numb with each one, but now, at this last ritual of the night, he found himself cursing the day he'd been chosen as a priest of the Crooked Warden. His presumed 13th birthday, under the Orphan's moon. What power and what magic it had seemed back then. The power and the magic to give funeral orations. He scowled, buried his cynical thoughts for Esri's sake, and continued. This is the woman who saved us all. This is the woman who beat Jafrim Rodanoff. We deliver her, body and spirit, to the realm of your brother Yono. Mighty Lord of the Sea, lend her aid, carry her soul to she who weighs us all. This we pray with hopeful hearts. Jean knelt over the canvas shroud, and on it he placed a lock of dark brown hair. My flesh, he whispered. He pricked his finger with a dagger and let a red drop fall. My blood. He leaned down to the unmoving head beneath the canvas, and left a lingering kiss. My breath and my love. These things bind your promise, said Locke. My promise, said Jean, rising to his feet. A death offering, Esri. God's help me to make it worthy. I don't know if I can, but God's help me. Zemira, standing nearby, stepped up to take one side of the wooden plank holding Esri's canvas-wrapped body. Locke took the other. Jean, as he'd warned Locke before the ceremony, was unable to help. He wrung his hands and looked away. In a moment it was over. Locke and Zemira tipped the plank, and the sailcloth shroud slid out the entry port into the dark waves below. It was an hour past sunset, and at long last they were truly done. The wordless circle of tired, mostly wounded crewfolk began to disperse, back to Tregane's fussing or their bare-bones watches. Rask had replaced Esri, Nazreen, and Utgar alike for the time being. With his head swaddled in a thick linen bandage, he began grabbing the more able-bodied survivors and pointing out chores for their attention. "And now?" asked Locke. Now we limp, with the wind mostly against us, back to Tal Varrar. Zemira's voice was tired, but her gaze was level. We had an understanding before this. I've lost more than I bargained for, friends and crew both. We lack the strength to take so much as a fishing vessel now, so I'm afraid what remains is up to you. As we promised, said Locke. Stragos. Yeah. Get us there, and I'll think of something. You won't have to, said Jean. Just put in and send me off. He looked down at his feet. Then leave. No, said Locke. I won't just stay here while... Only takes one for what I've got in mind. You just promised a death offering. She gets it. Even if it's me, she gets it. You think Stragos won't be suspicious to see just one of us? I'll tell him you're dead. Tell him we had a fight at sea. That part's honest enough. He'll see me then. I won't let you go alone. And I won't let you come with. What do you think you can do? Fight me? Shut up, the pair of you, said Zemira. Gods! Just this morning, Jerome, your friend here tried to convince me to let him do exactly what you're planning right now. What? Jean glared at Locke and ground his teeth together. "You miserable little sneak! How could you—" "What? How dare I contemplate what you were going to do to me? You self-righteous strutting cock, I'll—" "What?" shouted Jean. "I'll throw myself at you and you'll beat the shit out of me," said Locke, "and then you'll feel awful. How about that, huh?" "I already feel awful," said Jean. "Gods, why can't you just let me do this? Why can't you give me this much? At least you'll be alive. You can try to find another alchemist, another poisoner. It's a better chance than I'll have." "Like hell," said Locke. "That's not how we work. And if you wanted it otherwise, you should have left me bleeding to death in Camorre. I seem to recall being pretty set on it at the time."
"Yeah, but—"
"It's different when it's you, isn't it?"
"I—"
"Gentlemen," said Zemira, "or whatever you are, all other considerations aside, I gave my little boat to Bazarin this afternoon so the bastard could die on the waves instead of on my ship. You'll have a hell of a time getting one of the other boats into Talvara by yourself, Jerome. Unless you propose to fly, for I'm not taking the Orchid more than a bowshot past the breakwater reefs."
"I'll swim if I bloody well have to."
"Don't be stupid in your anger, Jerome." Drakasha grabbed him by the shoulders. "Be cold. Cold's the only thing that's going to work, if you're going to give me anything back for what's been done to my crew. For my first mate."
"Shit," Jean muttered.
"Together," said Locke. "You didn't leave me in Camorre or Velverazzo. The hell if I'll leave you here." Jean scowled, grabbed the rail, and stared down at the water.
"It's a damn shame," he said at last. "All that money at the Sinspire. Pity we'll never get it out. Or the other things."
Locke grinned, recognizing the abrupt change of subject as Jean's way of salving his pride as he gave in.
"Sinspire?" said Zemira.
"We've left a few parts of our story untold, Zemira. Forgive us. Sometimes these schemes get a bit heavy to haul around. We have a few thousand solari on the books at the Sinspire. Hell, I'd let you have my share if there were any way to get it, but the point is moot."
"If only we'd found someone in the city to hold some of it for us," said Jean.
"No use wailing over spilled beer," said Locke. "I doubt we cultivated a single friend in Talvara that we weren't hiring or tipping. Sure could use a fucking friend now." He joined Jean at the rail and pretended to be absorbed in the sea as the bigger man did, but all he could think of were shrouded bodies splashing into the water. Bodies falling, just as he and Jean had planned to use ropes to fall safely out of—
"Wait a god's damned minute," said Locke.
"A friend. A friend. That's what we fucking need. We've spun Stragos and Requin like plates. Who haven't we even bothered to deal with in the past 2 years? Who have we been ignoring?"
"The temples?"
"Good guess, but no. Who's got a direct stake in this bloody mess?"
"The Priori?"
"The Priori," said Locke. "Those fat, secretive, conniving bastards." Locke drummed his fingers against the rail, trying to push his sorrow out of his thoughts and will a dozen loose, improbable plans into one coherent scheme. "Think! Who'd we game with? Who'd we see at the Sinspire?"
"Ulena Pascalis."
"No, she just barely got her seat at the table."
"Domorella."
"No. Gods, nobody takes him seriously. Who could move the Priori to do something absolutely rash? Who's been around long enough to either command respect or pull strings to enforce it? Inner Seven is what we need. The hell with everyone else." Conjuring on the political realities of the Priori was akin to divination by chicken entrails, thought Locke. There were 3 tiers of Seven in the merchant councils. The purpose of every seat on the lower two was public knowledge. Only the names of the inner Seven were known. What hierarchy they held, what duties they performed, was a mystery to outsiders.
"Cordo," said Jean.
Old Cordo or Leonin?
Both. Either. Marius is inner seven, Leonin's on his way up, and Marius is older than Perelandro's balls. If anyone could move the Priory, presumably as part of some insane thing you're dreaming up...
It's only half insane.
I know that fucking look on your face. I'm sure either Cordo's the one you want. Pity we've never met the bastards.
Jean stared at Locke with a wary expression.
You do have that look on your face. What do you mean to do?
I mean, what if I mean to have it all? Why are we plotting suicide as a first option? Why don't we at least try first? Get to Requin, pull the job. Get to Stragos, squeeze an answer or an antidote out of him. Then give it to him, one way or another.
Locke mimed shoving a dagger into an invisible archon of Tal Varar. It was so satisfying he mimed it again.
How the hell do we do this?
That's a grand question, said Locke. The best question you've ever asked. I know we need some things. First, the way it's been lately, every person in Tal Varar is likely to be waiting for us at the docks with crossbows and torches. We need better disguises. Shoddiest priesthood of the 12?
Calo Androno, said Jean.
Begging his forgiveness, you got it, said Locke.
Calo Androno, eyes on the crossroads, god of travel, languages, and lore. His itinerant priests, as well as his settled scholars, disdained finery, taking pride in the roughness of their garments.
Zamira, said Locke, if there's anyone on board who can still push a needle and thread, we need two robes. Make them from sailcloth, spare clothes, anything. I hate to say it, but there's got to be a lot of spare clothing lying around now.
The survivors will dice for the goods, and I'll share out the coin among them, she said. But I can claim a few things first.
And we need something blue, said Locke. The blue Androni headbands. As long as we wear those, we're holy men, not just ill-dressed vagrants.
Esri's blue tunic, said Jean. It'd be in her cabin, where she left it. It's a bit faded, but...
Perfect, said Locke. Now, Zamira, when we came back from our first visit to Tal Varar with this ship, I gave you a letter for safekeeping. It has Requin's seal on it. Jerome, I need you to finesse that thing off like Chains showed us. You're better at it than me, and it has to be good.
I suppose I can try. I'm not sure how good I can be at anything right now.
I need your best. I need you to do it, for me and for her.
Where do you want the seal moved?
Clean parchment, paper, anything. Do you have one sheet, Zamira?
A full sheet? I don't think Paolo and Cosetta have left us any, but several of them are only partially scribbled on. I may be able to cut one in half.
Do it. Jerome, you'll find some of the tools you need in my old sea chest in Zamira's cabin. Can he use it? And some lanterns, Captain?
Paolo and Cosetta refused to come out of the rope locker, said Zamira. They're too upset. I've brought bedthings and alchemical lights down for them. The cabin is at your disposal.
You'll need your cards, too, said Jean. Or so I presume.
Hell, yes, I mean to use the cards. I'll need them, plus the best set of gear we can scrape together. Daggers, short lengths of cord, preferably demi-silk, coins, Zamira, tight little purses of 50 or 60 solari in case we have to buy our way past a problem, and some coshes. If you don't have any, there's sand and sail canvas.
And a pair of hatchets, said Jean.
There's two in my cabin. I took them out of your chest, actually.
What?
A flicker of excitement actually crossed Jean's face.
You have them?
I needed a pair. I didn't know they were special. Otherwise, I'd have given them back when you came off the scrub watch.
Special? They're more like family than weapons, said Locke.
So how does this all fall together, then? Said Jean.
As I said, excellent question. One I intend to ponder at length.
We won't see Tal Varar again until tomorrow night if this weather holds, said Zamira. I guarantee you'll have a good long time to ponder, and you'll be doing most of it up the foremast as top eyes. I still need you to make yourself useful." "Of course," said Locke, "of course. Captain, when we come in to Tal Varar, bring us from the north, if you would. Whatever else we do, our first stop needs to be the merchant's quarter."
"Cordo?" asked Jean.
"Cordo," said Locke. "Older or younger, I don't care. They'll see us if we have to crawl in through their god's damned windows."
2.
"What the?" said a portly, well-dressed servant who had the misfortune to walk around the corner past the alcove containing the fourth-floor window Locke and Jean had just crawled in through.
"Hey," said Locke, "congratulations! We're reverse burglars, here to give you 50 gold solari."
He tossed his coin purse at the servant, who caught it in one hand and gaped at its weight. In the next second and a half the man spent not raising an alarm, Jean coshed him. They'd come in through the northwest corner of the top story of the Cordo family manor. Battlements and iron spikes had made a climb to the roof unattractive. It was just shy of the 10th hour of the evening, a perfect mid-aurim night on the Sea of Brass, and Locke and Jean had already squirmed through a thorny hedgerow, dodged 3 parties of guards and gardeners, and spent 20 minutes scaling the damp, smooth stone of Cordo Manor just to get this far. Their makeshift priestly robes of Calo Androno, along with most of their other needs, were tucked into backpacks sewn with haste by Jabril. Possibly thanks to those robes, no one had loosed a crossbow bolt at them since they'd set foot on solid Ferrari ground. But the knight was young, thought Locke, so very, very young. Jean dragged the unconscious servant into the window alcove and glanced around for other complications while Locke quietly slipped the double frosted glass windows shut and rehitched their latch. Only a slender, carefully bent piece of metal had allowed him to open that latch. The right people of Camor called the tool a breadwinner, because if you could get in and out of a household rich enough to own latching glass windows, your dinner was assured. As it happened, Locke and Jean had stolen into just enough great houses much like this one, if none quite so vast, to know vaguely where to look for their quarry. Master bedchambers were often located adjacent to comforts like smoking rooms, studies, sitting parlours, and...
"Library," muttered Jean as he and Locke padded quietly down the right-hand corridor. Alchemical lights in tastefully curtained alcoves gave the place a pleasantly dim orange-gold glow. Through a pair of open doors in the middle of the hall on their left, Locke could just glimpse shelves of books and scrolls. No other servants were in sight. The library was a thing of minor wonder. There must have been 1,000 volumes, as well as hundreds of scrolls in orderly racks and cases. Charts of the constellations, painted on alchemically bleached leather, decorated the few empty spots on the walls. 2 closed doors led to other inner rooms, one to their left and one in front of them. Locke flattened himself against the left-hand door, listening. He heard a faint murmur and turned to Jean, only to find that Jean had halted in his tracks next to one of the bookshelves. He reached out, plucked a slim octavo volume, perhaps 6 inches in height, from the stacks, and hurriedly stuffed it into his backpack. Locke grinned. At that moment, the left-hand door opened directly into him, giving him a harmless but painful knock on the back of the head. He whirled to find himself face to face with a young woman carrying an empty silver tray. She opened her mouth to scream, and there was nothing else for it. Locke's left hand shot out to cover her mouth, while his right went for a dagger. He pushed her back into the room from which she'd come, and past the door Locke felt his feet sinking into plush carpet an inch deep. Jean came through right behind him and slammed the door. The servant's tray fell to the carpet, and Locke pushed her aside. She fell into Jean's arms with an oomph of surprise, and Locke found himself at the foot of a bed that was roughly 10 feet on a side, draped in enough silk to sail a rather substantial yacht. Seated on pillows at the far end of that bed, looking vaguely comical with his thin body surrounded by so much empty, opulent space, was a wizened old man. His long hair,
the colour of sea foam, fell free to his shoulders above a green silk gown. He was sorting through a pile of papers by alchemical light as Locke, Jean, and the unwilling servant woman all barged into his quarters.
"Marius Cordo, I presume," said Locke. "For the future, might I suggest an investment in some artificer gearwork for your window latches?"
The old man's eyes went wide and the papers scattered from his hands.
"Oh, gods!" he cried. "Oh, gods, protect me! It's you!"
3. "Of course it's me," said Locke. "You just don't know who the hell I am yet."
"Master Costa, we can discuss this. You must know that I am a reasonable and extremely wealthy man."
"All right, you do know who the hell I am," said Locke, disquieted. "And I don't give a shit about your money. I'm here to..."
"In my place, you would have done the same," said Cordo. "It was business is all, just business. Spare me and let that too be a business decision, based on gain of gold, jewels, fine alchemicals."
"Master Cordo," said Locke. "Look, I..." He scowled, turned to the servant. "Is this man, senile?"
"He's absolutely competent," she answered coldly.
"I assure you I am," roared Cordo.
Anger changed his countenance utterly.
"And I will not be put off from business by assassins in my own bedroom. Now, you will either kill me immediately or negotiate the price of my release."
"Master Cordo," said Locke, "tell me two things, and be perfectly bloody clear about them both. First, how do you know who I am? Second, why do you think I'm here to kill you?"
"I was shown your faces," said Cordo, "in a pool of water."
"In a pool of..." Locke felt his stomach lurch. "Oh, damn, by a..."
"By a Carthani bondsmage, representing his guild on a personal matter. Surely you now realize..."
"You," said Locke, "I'd have done the same in your place, is what you said. You've been sending those goddamned assassins after us. Those fuckers at the docks, that barkeeper with the poison, those teams of men on festa night."
"Obviously," said Cordo. "And you've been elusive, unfortunately, with a bit of help from Maxilan Stragos, I believe."
"Unfortunately? Unfortunately? Cordo, you have no idea what a lucky son of a bitch you are that they didn't succeed. What did the bondsmage I tell you?"
"Come now, surely your own plans..."
"Tell me in their words or I will kill you."
"That you were a threat to the Priory, and that in light of sums paid for their services previously, they thought it in their best interests to tender a warning of your presence."
"To the Inner Seven, you mean?"
"Yes."
"You stupid bastards," said Locke. "The bondsmage I used you, Cordo. Think on that next time you consider giving them money. We, Master Deferra and myself, are on their fuck-with list, and they tossed us between you and Stragos for a laugh. That's all. We didn't come here to do anything to the Priory."
"So you say."
"Why aren't I murdering you right now, then?"
"A simultaneously pleasing and vexing point," said Cordo, biting his lip.
"The fact is," said Locke, "that for reasons which are forever going to remain way the hell beyond your understanding, I've broken into your manor to do one thing. Give you the head of Maxilan Stragos on a platter."
"What?"
"Not literally. I have plans for that head, actually. But I know how God's damned happy you'd be to have the Arcanate kicked over like an anthill. So I'm only going to say this once. I mean to remove Maxilan Stragos from power permanently, and I mean to do it tonight. I must have your help."
"But you are some sort of agent of the Archon."
"Jerome and I are unwilling agents," said Locke. "Stragos' personal alchemist gave us a latent poison. So long as Stragos controls the antidote, we can serve him or die pretty awfully. But the fucker just had to keep pushing us, and now he's pushed us too far."
You could be provocateurs sent by Stragos to...
What? Test your loyalty? In what court? Under what oath? Before what law? Same question as before, this time in relation to the idiotic conjecture that I actually do Stragos' bidding. Why aren't I murdering you then?
As to that, a fair point.
Here, said Locke, moving around the bed to sit beside Cordo. Have a dagger. He tossed his blade into the old man's lap. At that moment, there was a pounding on the door. Father! Father! One of the servants is injured! Are you well? Father, I'm coming in!
My son has a key,
said the elder Cordo as the click of it sounded in the door mechanism. Ah, said Locke. I'll be needing this back then. He snatched his dagger again, stood beside Cordo, and pointed it at the old man in a vaguely threatening fashion. Hold still. This won't take but a minute. A well-built man in his mid-30s burst into the room, an ornate rapier in his hands. Leonis Cordo, second-tier priori, his father's only heir, and a widower for several years. Perhaps the most eligible bachelor in all of Tal Vahrar. All the more notable in that he rarely visited the Sinspire. Father! Ellison! Leonis took a step into the room, brandishing his weapon with a flourish and spreading his arms to block the door. Release them, you bastards! The household guards are roused, and you'll never make it down to the... Oh, for Perelandro's sake, I'm not even going to pretend, said Locke. He passed the dagger back to the elder Cordo, who held it between two fingers like some sort of captured insect. Look, there. What sort of whimsical assassin am I, then? Sheathe your sword, shut the door, and open your ears. We have a lot of business to discuss.
Leonis, said the elder Cordo, this man may be out of his mind, but as he says, neither he nor his partner are assassins. Put up your weapon and tell the guards to...
He turned to Locke suspiciously.
Did you badly injure any of my people breaking in, Costa?
One slight bump on the head, said Locke. Do it all the time. He'll be fine, whoever he was.
Very well.
Marius sighed and passed the dagger fussily back to Locke, who tucked it back into his belt.
Leonis, tell the guards to stand down. Then be seated and lock the door again.
May I go, if nobody's going to be doing any assassinating in these chambers? Asked Alison.
No, sorry. You've already heard too much. Take a seat and get comfortable while you listen to the rest. Locke turned to the elder Cordo. Look, for obvious reasons, she cannot leave this house until our business is done tonight, right?
Of all the...
No, Alison, he's right.
The elder Cordo waved his hands placatingly.
Too much rides on this, and if you're loyal to me, you know it. If, forgive me, you're not, you know it all the more. I'll have you confined to the study, where you'll be comfortable. And I'll compensate you very, very handsomely for this, I promise.
Released by Jean, she sat down in a corner and folded her arms grumpily. Leonis, looking as though he doubted his own sanity, briskly dismissed the squad of tough-looking brutes that pounded into the library a moment later, sheathed his rapier, and pulled the bedchamber door closed. He leaned back against it, his scowl matching Ellison's. Now, said Locke, as I was saying, by the end of this night, come hell or Eldrin fire, my partner and I will be in close physical proximity to Maxillan Stragos. One way or another, we are removing him from power. Possibly from life itself, if we have no choice. But in order to get there our way, we're going to need to demand some things of you. And you must understand, going in, that this is it. This is for real.
Whatever your plans are to take the city from Stragos, have them ready to spring. Whatever your measures are to keep his army and navy tied down until you can remind him who pays their salaries, activate them.
Remove Stragos?
Leonis looked simultaneously awed and alarmed.
Father, these men are mad!
Quiet, Leo. The elder Cordo raised his hand. These men claim to be in a unique position to effect our desired change, and they have declined to harm me for certain actions already taken against them. We will hear them out.
Good, said Locke. Here's what you need to understand. In a couple of hours, Master Deferra and I are going to be arrested by the eyes of the Archon as we leave the Sinspire.
Arrested? Said Leonis. How can you know?
Because I'm going to set an appointment, said Locke, and I'm going to ask Stragos to have us arrested. 4.
The Protector will not see you, nor will the Waiting Lady. Those are our orders.
Locke was sure he could feel the Eye Officer's disdainful glare even through his mask.
He will now, said Locke, as he and Jean pulled alongside the Archon's landing in the smaller, more nimble boat they had talked out of the Elder Cordo.
Tell him that we've done as he requested when we last met, and we really need to speak about it. The officer took a few seconds to consider, then went for the signal chain. While they waited for a decision, Locke and Jean removed all of their weapons and gear, stashed it in their bags, and left those in the bottom of the boat. Eventually, Meraine appeared at the top of the landing stairs and beckoned. They were patted down with the usual thoroughness and escorted up to the Archon's study. Jean trembled at the sight of Stragos, who was standing behind his desk. Locke noticed Jean clenching and unclenching his fists, so he squeezed his arm hard.
"Is this happy news?" asked the Archon.
"Has anyone come in to report a fire at sea yesterday, around noon, anywhere west of the city?" asked Locke.
2 merchant ships reported a large pillar of smoke on the western horizon," said Stragos. "No further news that I'm aware of, and no syndicate claiming any loss."
"They will soon enough," said Locke. 1 ship burnt and sunk, not a survivor aboard. It was headed for the city, and it was wallowing with cargo, so I'm sure it will be missed eventually.
Eventually, said Stragos. So what do you want now? A kiss on the cheek and a plate of sweetmeats? I told you not to trifle with me again until...
Think of our first sinking as earnest money, said Locke. We've decided that we want to show our wine and drink it, too.
Meaning what, exactly?
We want the fruit of our efforts at the Sinspire, said Locke. We want what we spent 2 years working for, and we want it tonight, before we do anything else.
Well, you can't necessarily have it tonight. What, did you imagine I could give you some sort of writ, a polite request to Requin to allow you to carry out whatever your game is?
No, said Locke. But we're going over there right now to pull it on him. And until we're safely away with our swag, not another ship gets sunk in your waters at the hands of the poison orchid.
You do not dictate the terms of your employment to me.
I do, actually. Even if we are trusting you to give us our lives back when our enslavement to you is complete, we're no longer confident that the conditions in this city will allow us to pull our Sinspire scheme after you get your way. Think, Stragos. We certainly have been. If you mean to put the Priori squarely under your thumb, there could be chaos, bloodshed and arrests. Requin's in bed with the Priori. His fortune needs to be intact if we're going to relieve him of any of it. So we want what's ours safely in our hands first, before we finish this affair for you.
You arrogant!
Yes, Locke shouted. Me, arrogant! We still need our fucking antidote, Stragos. We still need it from your hands. And we demand another extension, if nothing else. Tonight. I want to see your alchemist standing beside you when we return here in a couple of hours. Of all the bloody... What do you mean, when you return here? There's only one way for us to walk away safely from the Sin Spire once Requin knows we've taken him for a ride, said Locke. We need to leave the Sin Spire directly into the hands of your eyes, who'll be waiting to arrest us. Why, before all the gods, would I have them do that? Because once we're safely back here, said Locke, we will slip out quietly back to the Poison Orchid, and later this very night we'll hit the Silver Marina itself. Drakasha has 150 crewfolk, and we spent the afternoon taking two fishing boats to use as firecraft. You wanted the Crimson Flag in sight of your city? By the gods, we'll put it in the harbour. Smash and burn as much as we can, and hit whatever's in reach on our way out. The Priori will be at your gates with bags of money pleading for a saviour. The people will riot if they don't get one. Is that immediate enough for you? We could do what you wanted. We could do it tonight. And a punitive raid for the Ghostwind Isles. Well, how quickly can you pack your sea chest, Protector? What are you taking from Requin? Asked Stragos after a long, silent rumination. Nothing that can't be transported by one man in a serious hurry. Requin's vault is impenetrable. We know, said Locke. What we're after isn't in it. How can I be sure you won't get yourselves uselessly killed while doing this? I can assure you we will, said Locke. Unless we find immediate safety in the public legal custody of your eyes. And then we vanish, whisked away for crimes against the Verari state on a matter of the Arcanate's privilege. A privilege which you will soon be at leisure to flaunt. Come on, admit that it's bloody beautiful. You will leave the object of your desire with me, said the Archon. Steal it. Fine. Transport it here. But since you'll need your poison neutralized anyway, I will keep it for you until we part. That's a necessary comfort to myself, said Stragos, his voice laden with threat. Two men who knew themselves to be facing certain death could easily flee, and then drink, binge, and whore themselves in comfort for several weeks before the end. If they suddenly found a large sum of money in their hands, couldn't they? I suppose you're right, said Locke, feigning irritation. Every single thing we leave with you will be given scrupulous good care. Your investment of 2 years will be waiting for you at our parting of the ways. I guess we have no choice then. Agreed. Then I will have a writ made out immediately for the arrest of Leocanto Costa and Jerome de Ferra, said Stragos, and I will grant this request. And then, by the gods, you and that Syresti bitch had better deliver. We will, said Locke, to the utmost of our ability. An oath has been sworn. My soldiers... Eyes, said Locke, send eyes. They have to be agents of the Priori among your regulars. I'm staking my life on the fact that you keep more of an eye on your eyes, as it were. Plus, they scare the shit out of people. This is a shock operation. Said Stragos. The suggestion is reasonable. Then please listen carefully, said Locke. 5. It felt good to be stripping down to nothing. Emerging from a long spell of false facing could be like coming up for air after nearly drowning, Locke thought. Now all the baggage of their multi-tiered lies and identities was peeling away, sloughing off behind them as they pounded up the stairs to the Golden Steps one last time. Now that they knew the source of their mystery assassins, they had no need to sham as priests and skulk about. They could run like simple thieves with the powers of the city close on their heels. Which was exactly what they were. He and Jean should have been loving it, laughing about it together, revelling in their usual breathless joy at crime well executed. Richer and cleverer than everyone else. But tonight Locke was doing all the talking. Tonight Jean struggled to keep his composure until the moment he could lash out, and God's help whoever got in his way when he did. Carlo, Galdo, and Bug, Locke thought. Esri. All he and Jean had ever wanted to do was steal as much as they could carry and laugh all the way to a safe distance. Why had it cost them so many loved ones? Why did some stupid motherfucker always have to imagine that you could cross a Camorri with impunity? Because you can't, Locke thought, sucking air through gritted teeth as the Sin Spire loomed overhead, throwing blue and red light into the dark sky. You can't. We proved it once, and we'll prove it again tonight, before all the gods. 6.
Stay clear of the service entrance, you... Oh, gods, it's you! Help!
The bouncer who'd received Jean's painful ministrations to his ribs at their previous meeting recoiled as Locke and Jean ran across the service courtyard toward him. Locke saw that he was wearing some sort of stiff brace beneath the thin fabric of his tunic.
"Not here to hurt you," panted Locke. "Fetch Selendri. Fetch her now."
"You're not dressed to speak with..."
"Fetch her now and earn a coin," said Locke, wiping sweat from his brow. "Or stand there for 2 more seconds and get your fucking ribs rebroken."
Half a dozen Sin Spire attendants gathered around in case of trouble, but they made no hostile moves. A few minutes after the injured bouncer had disappeared within the tower, Selendri came back out in his place.
"You two are supposed to be at sea."
"No time to explain, Selendri. The Archon has ordered us to be arrested. There's a squad of eyes coming up to get us as we speak. They'll be here in minutes."
"What?"
"He figured it out somehow," said Locke. "He knows we've been plotting with you against him, and..."
"Don't speak of this here,"
Selendri hissed.
"Hide us! Hide us, please!"
Locke could see panic, frustration, and calculation warring on the unscarred side of her face. Leave them here to their fate, and let them spill everything they knew to the Archon's torturers? Kill them in the courtyard before witnesses without the plausible explanation of an accidental fall? No, she had to take them in, for the moment.
"Come," she said. "Hurry! You and you, search them!"
Sin Spire attendants patted Locke and Jean down, coming up with their daggers and coin purses. Selendri took them.
"This one has a deck of cards," said an attendant after fishing in Locke's tunic pockets.
"He would," said Selendri. "I don't give a damn. We're going to the 9th floor.
Into the grandeur of Requin's shrine to Avarice for one last time. Through the crowds and the layers of smoke hanging like unquiet spirits in the air. Up the wide spiraling stairs through the floors of increasing quality and risk. Locke glanced about as they went up. Was it his imagination, or were there no priori preening in here tonight? Up to the 4th floor, up to the 5th. And there, naturally, he nearly walked into Maracosa Durenna, who gaped with a drink in her hand as Selendri and her guards dragged Locke and Jean past her. On Durenna's face, Locke could see more than bafflement or irritation. Oh, gods, she was pissed. Locke could only imagine how he and Jean looked to her, hairier, leaner, and burnt brown by the sun. Not to mention underdressed, sweaty, and clearly in a great deal of trouble with the house. He grinned and waved at Durenna as they ascended the stairs, and she passed out of view. Up through the last floors, through the most rarefied layers of the house. Still no priori. Coincidence or encouraging sign? Up to Requin's office, where the master of the spire was standing before a mirror, pulling on a long-tailed black evening coat trimmed in cloth of silver. He bared his teeth at the sight of Locke and Jean, the malice in his eyes easily a match for the fiery alchemical glare of his optics.
"Eyes of the Archon," said Selendri, "on their way to arrest Costa and the Ferrer."
Requin growled, lunged forward like a fencer, and backhanded Locke with astonishing force. Locke slid across the floor on his ass and slammed into Requin's desk. Knick-knacks rattled alarmingly above him, and a metal plate clattered to the tiles. Jean moved forward, but the two burly Sinspire attendants grabbed him by the arms, and with a well-oiled click, Selendri had her concealed blades out to dissuade him.
"What did you do, Custer?"
roared Requin. He kicked Locke in the stomach, knocking him back against the desk once again. A wine glass fell from the desktop and shattered against the floor.
"Nothing!" gasped Locke. "Nothing! He just knew, Requin! He knew we were conspiring against him! We had to run! Eyes on our heels!"
"Eyes coming to my spire," Requin growled. "Eyes that may be about to violate a rather important tradition of the Golden Steps. You've put me in a very tenuous situation, Custer. You've fucked everything up, haven't you?"
"I'm sorry," said Locke, crawling to his hands and knees. "I'm sorry. There was nowhere else to run. If he got his hands on us..."
"Quite," said Requin. "I'm going down to deal with your pursuers. You two will remain here. We'll discuss this the moment I get back."
"When you come back," thought Locke, "you'll have more of your attendants with you, and Jean and I will slip out the window." It was time to do it. Requin's boot heels echoed first against tile, then against the iron of his little staircase as he descended to the level below. The two attendants holding Jean released him, but kept their eyes on him, while Selendri leaned back atop Requin's desk with her blades out. She stared coldly at Locke as he got back to his feet, wincing.
"No more sweet nothings to mutter in my ear, Costa."
"Selendri, I..."
"Did you know he was planning to kill you, Master de Ferra? That his dealings with us these past few months hinged on our allowing that to happen?"
"Selendri, listen, please."
"I knew you were a poor investment," she said. "I just never realized the situation would turn so quickly."
"Yes, you were right. I was a bad investment. And I don't doubt that Requin will listen more closely to you in the future. Because I never wanted to kill Jerome de Ferra. Jerome de Ferra isn't a real person. Neither is Carlo Callas. In fact," he said, grinning broadly, "you have just delivered us to exactly where we need to be for the payoff to 2 long years of hard work, so we can rob the fucking hell out of you and your boss." The next sound in the room was that of a Sinspire attendant hitting the wall, with the impression of one of Jean's fists reddening an entire side of his face. Selendri acted with remarkable speed, but Locke was ready for her, not to fight, but simply to duck and weave, and to stay away from that bladed hand of hers. He vaulted over the desk, scattering papers, and laughed as the two of them fainted from side to side, dancing to see who would stumble past its protective bulk first.
"You die then, Costa," she said.
"Oh, and you were planning to spare us? Please. By the way, Leocanto Costa's not real either. So many little things you just do not know, eh?" Behind them, Jean grappled with the second attendant. Jean slammed his forehead into the man's face, breaking his nose, and the man fell to his knees, burbling. Jean stepped behind him and drove his elbow down on the back of the man's neck with all of his upper body behind it. Involved as he was in avoiding Selendri, Locke winced at the noise the attendant's skull made as it struck the floor. A moment later, Jean loomed behind Selendri, blood from the attendant's broken nose streaming down his face. She slashed with her blades, but Jean's anger had him in a rare, vicious form. He caught her brass forearm, folded her in half with a punch to the stomach, whirled her around, and held her by the arms. She writhed and fought for breath. "This is a nice office," said Jean quietly, as though he'd just shaken hands with Selendri and her attendants rather than beaten the hell out of them. Locke frowned, but went on with the scheme. Time was of the essence. "Watch closely, Selendri, because I can only do this trick once," he said, producing his deck of fraudulent playing cards and shuffling them theatrically. "Is there a liquor in the house? A very strong liquor, the sort that brings tears to a man's eyes and fire to his throat?" He feigned surprise at the presence of a brandy bottle on the shelf behind Requin's desk, next to a silver bowl filled with flowers. Locke seized the bowl, tossed the flowers on the floor, and set the empty container atop the desk. He then opened the brandy bottle and poured the brown liquor into the bowl to a depth of about 3 fingers. "Now, as you can see, I hold nothing in my hands save this perfectly normal, perfectly ordinary deck of perfectly unremarkable playing cards. Or do I?" He gave the deck one last shuffle and then dropped it into the bowl. The alchemical cards softened, distended, and began to bubble and foam. Their pictures and symbols dissolved, first into a color-streaked white mess, then into an oily gray goo. Locke found a rounded buttering knife on a small plate at a corner of the desk, and he used it to vigorously stir the grey goo until all traces of the playing cards had vanished.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Selendri asked. "Making alchemical cement," said Locke. "Little wafers of resin painted to look like cards, formulated to react with strong liquor. Sweet gods above, you do not want to know what this cost me. Hell, I had no choice but to come rob you after I had it made."
"What do you intend?"
"As I know from vivid personal experience," said Locke, "this shit dries harder than steel." He ran over to the spot on the wall where the climbing closet would emerge, and he began to slather the grey goo all over the faint cracks that marked its door. "So once I painted all over this lovely concealed entrance, and then pour it into the lock of the main door, why, in about a minute, Requin's going to need a battering ram if he wants to see his office again this evening." Selendri tried to scream for help, but the damage to her throat was too much. It was a loud and eerie sound, but it didn't carry downstairs with the force she needed. Locke scampered down the iron stairs, closed the main doors to Requin's office, and hurriedly sealed the locking mechanism within a glob of already firming cement. "And now," he said when he returned to the center of the office, "the next curiosity of the evening, concerning this lovely suite of chairs with which I furnished our esteemed host. It turns out that I do know what the Talathri Baroque is, after all, and that there is a reason why someone in his right mind would build such a nice thing out of a wood as fundamentally weak as sheer crescent." Locke seized one of the chairs. He tore the seat cushion and its underlying panel off with his bare hands, exposing a shallow chamber within the seat packed tight with tools and equipment, knives, a leather climbing belt, clips and descenders, and assorted other implements. He shook these out onto the ground with a clatter, and then hoisted the chair above his head, grinning. "It makes them so much easier to smash." And that he did, bringing the chair down hard on Requin's floor. It shattered at all the joints, but didn't fly apart, because its splintered chunks were held together by something threaded through the hollow cavities within its legs and back. Locke fumbled with the wreckage for a few moments before successfully extracting several long lengths of demi-silk line. Locke took one of these, and with Jean's help soon had Selendri tied into the chair behind Requin's desk. She kicked and spat and even tried to bite them, but it was no use. Once she was secured, Locke picked a knife out of the pile of tools on the ground while Jean got to work smashing the other 3 chairs and extracting their hidden contents. As Locke approached Selendri with the blade in his hand, she gave him a contemptuous stare.
"I can't tell you anything meaningful," she said. "The vault is at the base of the tower, and you've just sealed yourselves up here. So frighten me all you like, Costa, but I have no idea what you think you're doing."
"Oh, you think this is for you?" Locke smiled. "Selendri, I thought we knew each other better than that. As for the vault, who the hell said anything about it?"
"Your work to find a way in."
"I lied, Selendri. I've been known to do that. You think I was really experimenting on clockwork locks and keeping notes for Maxilla and Stragos? Like hell. I was sipping brandies on your first and second floors, trying to pull myself back together after I nearly got cut to pieces. Your vault's fucking impenetrable, sweetheart. I never wanted to go anywhere near it. Locke glanced around, pretending to notice the room for the very first time. Requin sure does keep a lot of really expensive paintings on his walls, though, doesn't he? With a grin that felt even larger than it was, Locke stepped up to the closest one and began, ever so carefully, to cut it out of its surrounding frame.